Oh, man. Hey, y'all, my name's Jennifer Huddleston Kelly, and I am an alcoholic. I've been kept sober since December 5th of 92, and that's my miracle. And it is an honor and a privilege to get to be here. So excited. I'm all squishy. I have looked forward to this and dreaded it simultaneously for a long time. I don't know if I am intimidated or humbled, and I don't really think the word matters. I was in the room going, I have got imposter syndrome so bad right now. I was sitting at the table earlier and thinking, I don't even know what a character defect is. I mean, I've got them. I'm not saying I don't got them. I don't even know how to talk about them because I get caught up in just that thought of, I need to have deep and profound thoughts. And instead, I have stories about stealing poopery. And I don't want to tell those. I don't want to tell those. And yet, my defects, the things that come out in the steps that I get to talk about are the things that make me useful. And so as uncomfortable as it makes me to talk about them, and my ears are already red and toasty, I do know that being transparent and honest is really what, it's my superpower in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I am capable of being vulnerable and telling the whole truth. And I didn't come to you with that. I'm also your designated weeper, which is embarrassing. Everybody else just gets to talk and be cute, and I just, oh, God, he's so big, and I love him so much. It's just what I do. So I want to thank my hostess and the committee and all the other speakers. I wish I had time, but I've got 3 freaking steps, so I got to get to talking. And obviously it takes me a while to, you know, get going. So, fifth step. I try to stick with the steps that I'm on because I'm going to wander anyway. Fifth step. We pocket our pride and go to it. So, these 3 that I'm going to talk about, these were the terrifying ones for me. 5 in particular. I didn't want to be found out. I mean, I'm living a bunch of stuff. I love that, too. I was a preschool teacher who was a drunk. I went to a crack house one time wearing a little denim jumper with an apple on the front. I looked like the world's worst undercover cop. I mean, it was awful. Talk about some double life there, you know. I love that. I mean, I'm a phony and I'm a fake and I become whoever I think you want me to be. That's what my alcoholism does for me. It turns me into tofu. You know, you can just put me in the middle of something and I take on the flavor, you know, for better or for worse. Because I don't know who I am, but I'm certain I don't like her. And so drinking allowed me to become whoever I thought you wanted me to be, at least for a little while. And I could play dress up, and I would become. Here's how creative I am. One night we were in a cowboy bar, and me and my girlfriend decided we would be flight attendants. Only I choked when they asked me where I was from, and I said Omaha, you know, someplace glamorous and exotic. Omaha, have you ever been to Omaha? It's the green part of hell. I mean, there's just nothing there. But that's what I come up with, you know. And so I've been that way forever. I've been borrowing stories and being more than I am because at the heart of who I am, my essence, my character, I am certain I am not enough. No one has ever told me I'm not enough. Many, many, many people have told me I'm too much. But my core belief is that I'm just not enough. And so I sit down with this document that tells where I've been and what I've done and what I've thought and who I've hurt. And I don't want to share that with anybody. And I project and I say to myself, I don't want to share this because what will she think of me? I wish I was truly that altruistic. That's really not what I'm afraid of. What I'm afraid of is I'm going to have to face who I am and what I've done and how I've treated people and how I've used other people's love and affection as a weapon. You know, I really have. I didn't steal from strangers. I stole from, you know, the people who loved me and didn't want to think I would do that. And I don't want to look at that. And I don't want to look at that, that I'm capable of doing that sober. That didn't just stop because I stopped drinking. So I've got this document. I also have, you know, the big fat secret. Everybody's got the big fat secret, the one that if anybody finds out, they'll have to write a new pamphlet. I had the big fat secret, and I knew. I did one inventory, and I shared it with a sponsor, but my sponsor hadn't worked the steps out of the book. And so my inventory was pretty lame. It was 137 pages of resentments. Three columns. Didn't write four. Three columns. Pretty important information in that fourth column. Don't skip that. I didn't write about fear, and I didn't write about sex. I was really tired after a very long talk and a lot of crying. And so I slept through 6 and 7. We burned my inventory. So 8 was a couple of ex-boyfriends I thought I might want to see again. And then I thought I was on 8.5. You know, my sponsor wasn't really pushing me to do 9 because she'd never made any amends. So it was a pretty simple process, but then I'm walking around AA, kind of twitching. I've got my one-year chip, and I go on my first sober date, and some weird things happen on that I really don't want to talk about right now. But I've got a secret in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, from that first little sober date. And I'm filled with fear. And I've a lot of those old ideas about myself are cropping up, and I'm going to drink, and I know I'm going to drink. I don't want to drink. I don't want to leave you, but I don't know what to do. And so I went to a man in AA to tell him about what happened on my first little date, and it wasn't because I was looking for a solution. Well, not that kind of solution. I went to that man so that he would beat up the guy that I went on the little sober date with and kick him out of AA. And that's not what he did. What he did was he told me, you need a sponsor. You need to work the steps out of the book. And you need to do it real quick because what is done, and there's no reason for anybody to get drunk over it. But you need to get busy, and you need to get busy quick. And so there was a little angry woman with a big book strapped to her leg. She didn't really have a big book strapped to her leg, but it felt like she had a big book strapped to her leg in a holster, you know, just, you know, you've seen them. You've seen them. And they know right where to open up to. Doesn't matter what kind of nonsense you're talking, they know right where to open up to. And she had my number. She was so obnoxious. We were going to this detox center for women. I have my one-year chip. I'm saving lives here. And she is focused on me. She's not even looking at the detoxer. She's looking at, you know, twitchy me. And I can't figure out why. So I get uncomfortable with her. I think she might be attracted to me. And so I stopped sitting across the table from her because she kept trying to look into my eyeballs. I was not having any of that. My cuticles were pretty fascinating. And I like to do styrofoam cup art. And she just keeps trying to, you know, look into my eyeballs. And I don't know why. Probably because she's attracted to me. And then after the meeting one time, she walks up to me and she says, what step are you on? And she said it kind of like that. And this, you know, this face, like she smelled something bad. And I've gotten to where I shower regular. There's no reason for that kind of face. And I say 8.5. And she says, huh, just like that, huh. Walks off. That's it. That's our whole conversation. Huh. I got a long drive home, and I'm thinking about that. Huh. What does huh even mean? Huh. You're not my sponsor. Just found out my sponsor hasn't worked all the steps, but you're not my sponsor. I'll tell you that much right now. Huh. And I wound up alone in a room with that woman accidentally. You know, one of those accidental things where you show up someplace early, never been early before in your life, I'm early one time to a chick thing. I don't go to chick things. I'm at a chick thing early. One person in the room. What are the odds is what I'm saying, you know? But I had heard how you get rid of those women who are all up in your business. Let them help you one time. They'll leave you alone. Just let them help you one time. So I say, how do you find a sponsor? She picks out her little book. I'm thinking, it's not in there, sister. I've been reading for a year, hadn't found it. And she reads the part that says that the man who's making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he is talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer. And she is a woman with a real answer, and she became my freaking sponsor. But just for a little while, she was moving, which was good news, because I really was afraid of her. And I don't know that I could have taken her very long. But I did. I needed to work the steps like my life depended on it, because they did. And I now know why she kept trying to look me in the eye. Because it's a promise that if I had done a thorough fifth step, I could have looked her in the eye, and I couldn't. I think I'm on step 8, and I can't look somebody in the eye. And that promise right there is a tell, y'all. But we got to know. We got to know. I got to know that it's somebody who can't, with, you know, 7 years in AA, who's, you know, checking out the shoes, has a problem. They haven't come clean in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's important for me to know that. And because she knew the promise, she knew I was 911. Of every woman in that detox center, I was the one closest to the edge. And she knew it, and I was too arrogant to admit it. And so I go to do my fifth step with her, and I've got the thing. I've got the big fat secret, the big mama that I don't want to tell anybody. And I played a little game of chicken with God. I went to the Denny's recovery unit after the meeting, and we played the honesty game. Honesty was so new to me in recovery, we made a game out of it. Basically, we just sit around the table at Denny's, and you could ask a question. Most of them had to do with sex, and everybody answered the question honestly. It was so fun. But that night, we were playing the honesty game, and I had made a deal with God that I was going to ask people about, you know, their fifth step. And what the worst thing on it was, and if anybody mentioned my thing, then I would share it in my fifth step. But if nobody mentioned my thing, must not be God's will. And so we play the honesty game, and the people at the table start sharing their stuff, and, you know, somebody stole money from a church, and somebody held a gun to somebody's head, and, you know, somebody slept with their sister's husband, you know, just regular things. It was really kind of pitiful. And I'm thinking, well, I'm in the clear. I don't have to share the big fat thing. I don't have to share my secret. And so I sit down with my sponsor, and we begin to do the fifth step thing. And the first thing that she did was quiz me. And she said, why do we do a fifth step? And I don't really know the answer, except you have to. I really thought it was like AA hazing. It was just this whole thing. They just go through, because everybody says you're a member of AA after you finish your fifth step. You're really a member, a full member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know who says that. I just remember hearing it. I may have heard it from my head. But everybody up here says. Anyway. And so, but I don't. I know there's a right answer. I just know I don't know it. And so when I don't know, I wing it. And so I'm just talking. And I do this with the ladies I sponsor, and so, you know, and it's always like, oh, so that we can find our character defects and walk hand in hand with the spirit of the universe and the three legacies and the big book picnic. I don't know, you know, I'm just going to keep saying words until I see something like warm, you know. It's not happening. And finally, she just let me talk for a long time. I think she found me quite entertaining. And then she opened up the book, as she was wont to do. And it says, the best reason first, we might not overcome drinking. Oh, yeah, the drinking thing. Whoops. We might not overcome drinking. Okay, so then she comes up with this novel idea that we should pray before we begin. And I don't remember exactly what she prayed. I remember what it sounded like, because mind you, I'm sitting in this fifth step and I'm not going to share the big fat thing. God lost. And so, you know, we're praying and she says, God, please help Jennifer be honest. Because if she is not honest, she will drink and she will die a slow and painful alcoholic death. And it had something to do with turning yellow and an extended, you know, it was just this long prayer, very focused on honesty or death. And again, this is just what I heard. It might not have been what she said. I really could do an hour on the fifth step, but there are two things that I need to tell. I need to tell about the big fat secret. So I read the first piece of my inventory, and you know, she tells me a little bit about herself, and she asks me a question about what I had written. She tells me I did a good job. We turn to the second page. I'm waiting for something terrible to happen because I've got the big fat secret that I'm not going to tell. Nothing happens. Nothing happens. I don't burst into flames. Nothing. Second piece of my inventory. Here we go. I read the thing. She tells a little bit about herself. She points out a little observation. She asks me a question. I answer the question. Still got the big fat secret. Nothing. This is a piece of cake. I could totally do this and not tell. We get to the third piece of my inventory. The third piece of my inventory is about a guy who had the audacity not to 13th step me. He tried to 13th step everybody in the group but me. And I was not the bottom of the barrel, is what I'm saying. I sponsored most of his ex-girlfriends. I'm telling you, I was a much better catch than several of them. And so, you know, we're reading. I read the thing, get to the fourth column, read that whole deal. She asks me one question. No bright lights, no waterboarding, no bamboo shoots under the fingernail, nothing. One freaking question. And I fold like a cheap lawn chair. Here comes the big fat secret. Blah, 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 you know, and I'm like, man, that was, he didn't make it far. And the question was, are you straight? Because I was kind of rocking sort of an androgynous vibe. And I'm like, I don't know. And she said, well, what's your experience with this? I said, I'm pretty sure I'm a lesbian that doesn't like women. And that's what she did. And she said, well, have you ever taken any action on that? And I said, I'm not sure how you do. And she said, well, maybe. I said, I'm just not sure. I just don't know. And there's a very long and involved story that goes back to my teenage years that has to do with all this confusion. But she just says, well, why don't you ask God? And I said, well, what if he gives me the wrong answer? And she said, say that again. And I said, what if he gives me the wrong answer? And she said, say that a little louder. And she made me keep repeating that until I finally heard myself. And she said, there is no wrong answer. Maybe you just need to know for you. And let me tell you something. If it's okay with you, God, and your sponsor, it's okay. And if it's okay with you, God, and your sponsor, you'll never have to explain or defend it to anybody because it's okay with you, God, and your sponsor. But maybe just for you, you ought to explore this and ask God to show you. And so I did some things that she told me to do, and I did some writing, and I did some prayer, and I actually went and got some outside help for some things that had happened during my drinking that were problematic, and I got an answer. And you may think, because I'm married to the sweet big daddy, that you know the answer that I got. And maybe you're right, and maybe you're not. I don't have to explain or defend it with anybody, because it's okay with me, God, and my sponsor. And once I got that out of the way, the rest of the stuff was like, yeah, I steal stuff a lot. And I lie, and I, you know, man, I mean, once you got the big fat daddy out of the way, whoa, it was just flowing. And so I'm sharing this stuff, and I'm sharing this stuff that has held me hostage. I'm sharing this stuff that has decided where I can go and what I can do and where I can sit and who I can be friends with. I'm sharing this stuff that has held me hostage for years and years and years. And she's telling me stuff about herself. And I'm finding out, much to my chagrin, I'm pretty much a garden variety alcoholic. And some things begin to happen as she and I share. And I wish I could talk about all the miraculous things that happened, but there was one thing that was pretty profound. And it has influenced my recovery ever since. In the big book, several places, it talks about a spiritual experience revolutionizing our lives, revolutionizing. And I'm a big dictionary gal, not because I'm a big dictionary gal. I'm a big dictionary gal because one of my sponsors was a big dictionary gal. And so I looked up the word revolution, and there are two definitions for revolution. One is like a revolving door. It is taking some, looking at something from a different perspective. And here's my story about that. I was writing my inventory on my mother, and my sweet little mother is a lot of things, but she, especially growing up, she just didn't know how to do mommy-daughter things. She was an only child, and she was kind of raised as an adult, and so there wasn't a lot of toenail painting and bubble baths and stuff like that. She did the best she could with what she had, but, you know, she didn't bake cupcakes. She was a school teacher, a high school teacher, and she was really busy, and she was kind of the duct tape that held our whole family together, And so there was a lot of stuff on my inventory that had to do with, you know, just not feeling like I was one of the girls, because my mother never showed me how to be one of the girls, because my mother didn't know how to be one of the girls. And I didn't know my mother didn't know how to be one of the girls. That's what came out in the inventory. So I'm talking about how, you know, I would ask my mother if I was pretty. And I hate crying. And she would quote a line from the play Our Town, because she was an English teacher. And she would say something about having good features. All my children have good features. But I just kept thinking, why couldn't my mom just tell me? It's like, you're supposed to just tell your daughter she's pretty, even if she's not. She didn't know how to do that. She just didn't know how to do that. My dad was the one who did the ponytails and the fingernail painting, and he knew how to do that stuff. I have no idea how, and I don't really want to explore that, but because he was a football coach. But my mom just didn't know about that. And so as we were talking about all the things my mom didn't do and whatever, my sponsor said, well, tell me about your grandmother. And I was like, oh, she was a broom rider. And she was, okay? I'm just saying, sure, she's a precious child of God, but woo, she was a rough woman. And I said, you know, she knew the commandments God forgot to write down. She had a lot of rules, and she was real rigid, and she had expectations, and everybody lives up to them, and she could smell the fear on me, let me tell you. She ran me around the block every time I saw her, And she said, well, tell me about how your grandmother was raised. And I didn't know a lot at the time, but I knew a little bit. And there came a time when my grandmother was being raised when they couldn't keep all the children in the home. My grandmother was the oldest and the smartest and the strongest, and so they sent her away to live with an aunt and uncle for a while. And I started trying to imagine, as my sponsor and I were talking, how it would feel to be a young girl who was being sent away. Would you be able to process that and think, you know, I'm the strongest and I'm the smartest and I'm the most capable, and that's why they're sending me away? It's probably not what I would think. What I would think is, I'm disposable. I am powerless and I am disposable. And all of a sudden, I start to see my grandmother as somebody who lived her whole life in the first step, never, ever wanting to feel powerless again. That's why she had rules about how every freaking thing had to be done her way, because that's where she got her sense of okay. And then I look at how she raised my mother, and how my mother absorbed some of that and did the best she could with what she had been given. But all of a sudden, in an instant, my resentment with my mother has disappeared. Because all of a sudden, I realize I've been trick-or-treating for something my mom just didn't have. I'm like, I want a Snickers. I want a Snickers. I want a Snickers. And she's like, look, I got M&Ms. I got, you know, I got all this other stuff. And all I can see is she's not giving me the Snickers. Instead of, she doesn't have the Snickers. She just doesn't have it. And it's gone. That resentment is gone instantaneously, because I am revolutionized by sharing this with another woman. Because I look at this from a different angle. And not only can I no longer see all the things she's not, but in a moment I can see all the things she is. I am because she is. I don't sit around going, oh my gosh, I'm 55 and gravity has done a number on my body and oh, my worth as a human being is gone. No, it never was. The packaging never was who I am. That's the gift she gave me. I never believed that was where my value lied. That was a gift. I saw it as some way I was being cheated today. I am so thankful that I didn't walk into the world thinking my boobs were my value. Good Lord, that's got to be exhausting. And I can see how generous and how loving and how kind and how gracious my mother is. I could do a lot worse than turning out like Charlotte Huddleston. And I walked into that whole thing just real busy, thinking about all the things she wasn't. And I walked out so thankful for all the things she was. The other definition for a revolution is the overthrowing of a government. Whoops. And those are the doozies. Because I don't care who you vote for, the government lies. And the government lives up here. And the government tells me the rules. The government tells me the rules nobody else had to tell me. Tells me how the world works. And that's where 6 and 7 come in. That's where 6 and 7 come in. Because we got to start overthrowing the government. And that's going to take some time. It's just going to take some time. For a long time, I went home and I just did what the book told me to do. You know, I did my fifth step. I went home. I reviewed my work, the mortar without sand. Blah, blah, blah. You know, I went over and I asked myself if I left anything out. I took that hour. And I said the 7th step prayer, and I started writing my 8th step list. And that, as far as I was concerned, that's how it was done. And to some degree, it is. You know, unless you count the rest of your life, which is a bit of a problem for me. Because I don't go forth and behave well. I don't know. I'm sure you did. But I did not. I went to jail right before I turned 10 years sober, you know, because I threw away a ticket, you know. I mean, that's just how I roll. Ain't nothing in the big book about you got to pay your tickets every, you know. I mean, unless you're looking for it, which I was not. And, you know, there were just some things that belonged to me. And so when I got done with that first fifth step, the first real one, one of the things that I was most uncomfortable with from that inventory at that time was my gossiping problem. I like to share. And people give me information for fun and for free. And so I became my first home group's news source. And I thought it was pretty precious. I mean, I really did. And my whole attitude about the whole thing now, it just kind of cracks me up, because it was like, look, it was too good for you to hang on to. Why did you think I was going to be able to keep the secret? Everybody, alcoholics walking around going, okay, you can't tell anybody. Come on now. Yes, I can. Watch. But I'm going to walk to you and go, okay, but you can't tell anybody. So by the 19th person, we've all been told you can't tell anybody. And so when I shared that fifth step, and my sponsor kind of glommed right onto that thing. I mean, it's so weird when you're doing a fifth step, because the stuff that I thought she was going to roll up the newspaper and bop me on the nose for, she was like, oh, yeah, okay. Just went right past that one. The gossip thing, I swear, I didn't even think that was going to be a blip on the radar. She was honing right in on that bad boy. It was like, okay, we've kind of covered that, you know, and she kept coming back to it over and over again. I was like, this is a problem, and it was. And what was a problem about it was that, I'd started working with others. And while, to my knowledge, I have not shared fifth-step information, there was no reason for the women that I sponsor to believe I wouldn't. Because I'm running around AA going, did you hear about such and such and such and such? I got news. Come to Denny's. You know, I mean, so why would they think that all of a sudden I have this magical power where I can keep my mouth shut with their stuff? And when it was presented to me in that way, I was horrified. I was horrified. I got a birthday card from somebody, and it said something about, we'll be friends forever because you know too much. And at first I chuckled, and then I was like, that's true. Like, I'm blackmailing people with my inability to keep my dang mouth shut. And so I wanted it gone. And I did what most alcoholics do. I decided I would work on that myself. It's already been mentioned. I'm working on my character defects. I, too, agree. Step away from those people. Because that's an alcoholic trying to be good. It's not going to last long. And when it blows, it's blowing. You know, it's like you're wearing full body Spanx. You know, you're just... Okay, guys, I'm just telling you, it's real uncomfortable. Just squishing everything in. And so what happened was, I had done my inventory on like a Wednesday or Thursday, and on Friday night, we always went to the meeting and dinner. And afterwards, I mean, the whole way to El Phoenix, I'm like, I will not gossip, I will not gossip, I will not gossip, I'm not going to gossip, I'm not going to gossip, all right? Whatever it takes, will not gossip. I didn't ask God to remove the gossip. I got this. Check. So, we go to this Mexican food restaurant. My butt has not even hit the chair. And suddenly somebody goes, oh, did you hear about such and such and such and such? And I'm like, oh, God. So I start eating chips. Because it's the only thing I know to do. I was taught some manners. Can't talk with your mouth full. Just eat the chips. Just eat the chips. Just eat the chips. Just eat the chips. Food comes. They're still talking. There's information they don't even have. They're missing a crucial part of the story. Eat the chips. Gonna need some more tortillas, you know, and I'm here we go. Y'all, by the time dinner is done, I have eaten my food, your food, the tissue paper in the chip basket. I've done a couple of salsa shots. I have eaten nonstop for about 2 full hours. I am like the rat after the fair in Charlotte's Web. I am so full. I'm about to die. But I am walking out to my, waddling out to my car. So dang proud, I almost broke my own arm, patting myself on the back. I have fully solved the gossiping problem. Done! And I get in that car, and I have not even got the key in the ignition before I start going, you know, those losers. I don't know how they even stay sober acting the way they act. I mean, that little hooker has no right to judge anybody. And by the time I get home, I have character assassinated every single person at that table, which is exactly what happens when I'm removing my own character defects. We're just playing whack-a-mole. One goes down, three come up, one goes down. That's what happens, because I'm managing. And so today, as I was thinking about it, it was like, well, how do I know, really, how do I know what's a character defect? The 12 talks about the seven deadly sins, and okay, and the big book talks about selfishness, self-seeking, dishonesty, and fear, and okay, so, but what, seriously, how do I define, because I've sat around in meetings where people talk about my character defect of smoking, and is that a character defect? I don't know if that's a character, is it a character defect? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. That's really sort of something that I have to define. And I'm just going to tell you how I define it. I am no authority. Look, there's some people got some stuff going on in here. I'm Skittles. You know, I'm not bringing the heat is what I'm saying. But my thought about this is the way that I would qualify it. I have two questions that I would ask myself. One is it a pacifier? And if my answer is yes, it's a character defect, because God's supposed to be my pacifier. He is supposed to bring me peace. And my second question is, or is it a weapon? And that's the tougher one, because a weapon gives me the illusion of being safe. A weapon in my hands is not keeping me safe. I can promise you that. There's a reason I don't have a handgun. I would have fewer toes if I had a handgun. They don't trust me with a sharp scissors. Seriously, I literally cut my hair in the bathroom with some toenail clippers earlier. So I'm creative. Anyway, probably shouldn't have shared that. But I'm just gonna keep it light for the newcomer. These are the promises. So anyway, why in the hell did I just share that? That's all I'm going to think about now. Why did I say that? God's in charge. So is it a tool or is it is it a pacifier or is it a weapon? And because weapons give me the illusion of being safe. But what a weapon really does is a weapon tells you to back off. A weapon tells you to back off. You are my connection. Because if I backed you off, you can bet I've backed God off. If I am separated from you, I am separated from God. If I am separated from God, I am really close to a drink. My only defense comes from a power greater than myself. So anytime there is a sever in the connection, either direction, I am in danger. So I got to look at what are those weapons? What are those pacifiers that I am using and relying upon? And so I don't know for sure. You know, I had an incident recently that I really don't want to talk about, but I guess I'm supposed to. I was at a conference in California recently. I wish it was a long time ago. It was this year. And I didn't know it, but I was not spiritually fit. I was spiritually seeking, but I was not spiritually fit. And I was in a bit of a twitchy spot, and there was an afternoon break. And my hostess, who was delightful, said, I'm gonna go lay by the pool in my bathing suit. And I said, I am not going to do that. So I didn't even bring a bathing suit, and I'm not going to do that here anyway. So not a lot of skirts around the pool in Southern California. So... But on the way into the hotel, I had seen a little casino, and I like casinos. They're fun to me. And so I thought, no harm, no foul. I'll take a little Uber over to the casino. I won't do anything stupid because I only have a little bit of time. I have to be back for the banquet. It will be fine. And so I take this Uber to the casino, and I'm just going to do a little light gambling. And if you had asked me prior to this, I would have told you the gambling is my character defect. I don't believe that now. I believe the gambling was a symptom of my spiritual fitness. And so I go over to the casino. I do what I said I was going to do. I didn't lose a lot of money. I didn't go bananas. When it was time to go home, I was about ready to go, you know, to take the cab back to the hotel. I went to my purse to get out my iPhone. And my iPhone was not there. And I had not felt that way since early in recovery, because the phone was gone. I am at a casino. Nobody knows where I am. I don't know how to reach anybody at the hotel. I sure as heck don't want to call them and go, hey, funny story. Your speaker, God, I'm horrified. I'm running around, and I've got that flop sweat on me. It's awful. It is awful. And I managed to find a helpful security guard. I left the phone in the Uber. It turned into this really bad detective agency thing where I wound up, we stalked the dude using Find My iPhone and wound up at a gated community. Who is an Uber driver who lives in a gated community? Anyway, and so eventually we found a helpful security guard there, and I got the iPhone back. But it wasn't until I got home, just mortified that I had done that, that I had snuck off by myself in a room full of solution. I'd snuck off by myself to go gamble. I would have told you before this that the gambling was my character defect. I don't believe that now. Because what came about was that I began to really do some seeking and some writing and some digging deeper. And what was going on was that I live with my sweet little mama, and she's aging, and she's having some memory problems, and she's having some blood sugar problems, and there are days when she wakes up and she's really disoriented. And it's scaring me to death. It's just scaring me to death. And I thought that this all started with the beginning of the memory problem, but as I did some writing, I discovered that it kind of kicked into gear with COVID, and then I looked a little further, and it actually started about 2 years ago when she had a car wreck and she didn't know exactly what happened. And I've been running on fear for 2 years trying to keep my mama alive. And all it took was a couple of pages to discover that's not my department. And I can't keep my mama alive. The character defect is I'm trying to do God's job. I hadn't surrendered. How do we become entirely ready? We got to surrender. That's the hard part. Giving it to God, fine. It's me getting done with all my little plans and designs. It's me getting done with plan A, B, C, D, E, F. We got to get a monitor. We got to track our food. Oh my gosh, I've become a terrorist. I'm a blood sugar terrorist at our house, you know? What's your number? We don't even say good morning anymore. It's just, what's your number, you know? And I think she'd be ready to go home, you know, after living with me for a while, trying to save her. But I don't know that. I don't know that that's what's going on, that I'm playing God, that one more time I'm doing things that aren't my department. I'm running around trying to do God's job. And so when I look for my character defects, I got to look for those things that come between me and God, those substitutes, that Swiss Army knife of bad behaviors that I still have. And I wish I could tell you I'm 29 years sober and I don't some days wake up and come out of the storm cellar and think, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? But sometimes I do. And this is why I get comfortable enough with the discomfort of my bad behavior. I get busy writing myself excuses for the way that I'm acting instead of slowing down, looking at it, acknowledging it, and giving it to God. I'm so busy defending my position on why it's really okay. Six is the kicker for me, not seven, six. During the pandemic, I start doing some writing. I'm doing an inventory on my dad, and my dad's dead, by the way. People can die and they still wind up on your freaking inventory, which seems unfair. It seems like that should have been finished, you know, but it wasn't. And as I was doing the writing on my dad, it was really all surrounding weight, surrounding my relationship with food. And as I shared that with my sponsor, I just said, I don't know what to do anymore. And I don't want to admit I'm killing myself. I don't want to go. My body's not working the way it is supposed to. And the scary thing is that I've surrendered this over and over and over and over again, and I mean it every time. I mean it every time. I think it's going to be different every time. And I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, good. Let's start praying. And we started praying. And I don't know if that problem is solved, but I know that I am seeking solutions. I know I am doing something different. And the cool thing is, when I start doing something different, I become more useful. These are removed so that I can be more useful. But sometimes they aren't removed at once because I am more attractive with the twitch than I am without it. And maybe we're supposed to work through it together. I have a sponsee, because I shared about stealing, which I hate admitting sober, that I stole stuff sober. And I don't steal like formula for the baby, by the way. You know, I steal sparkly toenail polish. Stupid stuff. I steal stuff that I've got the money in my purse to buy, because it's not about the stuff, it's about my spiritual condition. It's a reaction to my spiritual condition. But I start sharing about that, and I get a sponsee. She comes up to me after the meeting. She says, I steal stuff too. And we start working on this stuff together. You know, I was single for a long, long time in AA. I was single a long time in AA. And I was 30 years old learning how to date. And my sponsor taught me all these dumb rules about dating. A date has a beginning, a middle, and an end. The beginning is at a reasonable hour, and the end is before midnight, or you turn into a pumpkin. A date involves here to here and here to here. Nothing in the hot zone. You go out on a date. You come home after the date. I mean, there was all this stuff. And dating goes on for months. Months. And, like, pages of the calendar. First, you got to be friends. And if he's a crappy friend, you don't even go on the date. It's so dumb. Kept going, no guy in the world will do this. Well, they will. If they really like you, they will. That's what I found out. So I do this and this and this and this. And they have to ask me out by, you know, whenever. It can't be like 10 minutes. Can you go on a date in 10 minutes? I have to say I have a commitment if they ask 10 minutes early, because my commitment is to thine own self be true. It's not about playing games. It's about learning how to trust God. When I start trusting God, kind of people I start to date changes. So I start sponsoring these young girls who have never even been on a date. They've never been on a date. They've never been on a date. And I start explaining here to here and here to here, beginning, middle, and end. You can't do 10 dates in one night and call it a date. He hasn't left my house in 14 days. That's not a date. And these little girls start calling me, and they start saying, this is really hard. I mean, this is really hard. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm 35. The eggs are dying while we're on the date. But as I begin to trust God in this area, not only is the bar raised for me, but for these ladies walking beside me. Because I can tell them, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the right man will court you. He will. You will be pursued. And the other thing is, if you're not, you will build a life that you are in love with, and that is full and rich and wonderful, that is not missing a single thing. That's what was going on when the man of my dream showed up. was I was so in love with my life that I could say beyond a shadow of a doubt that if it's God's will, I can't run it off. And if it's not God's will, I can't make it stay. And I got to show up honest and open and willing to see where God wanted us to go. In 6 and 7, I start to surrender those things, little by slow. I got one more little story to tell you. When I got sober, I was a preschool teacher because God knew where I needed to be, new and twitchy. And there was a little boy in my class, and he had a blanket, you know, the blanket. He'd had the blanket since he was teeny tiny, and now he's 4 and a half. And it's nasty. That thing could just be stood up in the corner. You know, it's got every kind of DNA known to man on it. It's gross. It started out blue. It's now gray. And his mother is just really having a hard time with the blanket situation. She's like, I know the books say he's going to surrender it. He is not. He will take this blanket to college if we don't do something about it. And so as a family, they came to a decision, and they decided that he would give up, that he would never have to give up the blanket. He would never have to give up the blanket. But that each week they would cut off 1 inch of the blanket. Just 1 inch. And so every Monday morning they would get up and they would have the blanket cutting ceremony. And they would cut off the one strip of the blanket, and everyone would cheer. And he would come to school, and he would display the blanket, which was 1 inch smaller. And every Monday, little by slow, 1 inch at a time. And today I know that Brian surrendered that blanket so that I would learn how. There are some things that we just have to do 1 inch at a time. And the cool thing is that the closer I get to God, the more I realize that he's never asked me for more than that. I'm the one who makes up these stupid rules. I'm the one who thinks that God's ashamed of me. God designed me. I'm the one who's ashamed. As I keep surrendering to God, God keeps saying, baby, I never ask you for the gambling. I ask you for the fear. Will you give me the fear? We'll let the gambling take care of itself. Will you give me the fear? Your mama belongs to me. Will you let me have your mama? And one day at a time, 1 inch at a time, he gets her. And I get to be free. The same is true with all of my defects. Whether I can surrender them all at once or 1 inch at a time, with each little surrender, I get a little more God and a little more free. And I become a little more useful. And that's the gift. A little more useful. That's what I've always wanted to be. I thought I wanted to be that pretty thing on the shelf that everybody polished up and said, oh, isn't that lovely? I found out I want to be a bucket or a basket. I want to be a really cool container. And most of the time, I want to be as empty as humanly possible so that God can fill me and feed you. And I hope I did that just a little bit today. I'm glad to be here, and it's a good day to be sober.